Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Holocaust and the NACAB were put in the spotlight this week as rhetoric ramped up in the debates over Canadian citizenship and terrorism. We'll have the Defense and Multiculturalism Minister Jason Kenney on to discuss the issues, and after, we'll speak with a representative of a national Muslim organization.
The government's controversial anti-terror legislation is now being reviewed by a House of Commons committee. The ministers responsible for the bill, as well as many critics, have already given their testimony. We'll speak with the former chair of the Security Intelligence Review Committee, Ron Atkey, to get his take on the bill.
The McLean's panel weighs in on the future of the mission in Iraq following the recent friendly fire death of a Canadian soldier.
And just before St. Patrick's Day, Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister is in Canada for bilateral meetings and a few Paddy's Day festivities. He joins us on the show to discuss Irish-Canadian relations.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau delivered a hard-hitting speech in Toronto this week, lashing out at the Harper government's stance toward Muslims, comparing it to immigration policies against Jews before World War II. He took aim at the conservative policy against face veils being worn by immigrant women taking their Canadian citizenship oath. Now, that restriction, which is aimed mainly at the niqab worn by a small minority of Muslim women, was struck down by a federal judge last month, but Prime Minister Stephen Harper has decided to appeal that decision. Trudeau called it a cruel joke to claim you're liberating people from oppression by dictating in law what they can and cannot wear.
And that's when he made his controversial comments.
So we should all shudder to hear the same rhetoric that led to a none is too many immigration policy toward Jews in the 30s and 40s being used to raise fears against Muslims today.
Jason Kenney is the defense minister as well as the minister responsible for multiculturalism. Back in 2011, when he was immigration minister, Kenney was responsible for bringing in the policy of banning face covering during the citizenship ceremony. Kenney spoke over the phone with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about the issue, and John started out by asking him about Trudeau's speech.
Well, I think his speech was outrageous and beyond the pale. To compare an anti-Semitic to compare anti-Semitic immigration restrictions during the Holocaust to a request that people take the public citizenship oath publicly demonstrates that a grotesque lack of judgment on his part. The facts so profoundly belie everything he said and intimated. It almost seems ridiculous to try to rebut what he said. I mean, this is the government that's maintained the highest immigration levels in our history since coming to office. Over 300,000 Muslims have immigrated to Canada. Ours is the government that opposed the Quebec Charter has stood up in court for the rights of Sikhs to carry kirpans to schools and allowed them into embassies, that has stood up for pluralism in every way. This is the most pluralistic and arguably pluralistic and pro-immigration government in the world.
Why would you even come close to risking any of that reputation that has brought to you for something that it has to involve? What, like a tiny handful?
Well, let me tell you something, John, that politically correct Canadian liberals don't understand, which I do rather profoundly, which is that the vast majority of new Canadians, including new Canadians of the Muslim faith, believe that there are certain important hallmarks of integration. They believe that multiculturalism is not, should not be misconstrued as cultural relativism. They believe that multiculturalism should mean a positive regard for what's best about people's cultural and religious antecedents, but it should not mean a completely unquestioned acceptance of every cultural practice, particularly those of the most aberrant nature. And I can tell you that the vast majority of Muslims with whom I have spoken strongly supported my decision in 2010 to state what I thought was tautological, was axiomatic, that a public citizenship ceremony has to be performed publicly. So it seems to me that there's a point at which some politically correct liberals suspend their ability to think critically about these things and to actually see some nuance and make some distinctions. And I think that's really what's at stake here.
I object to the notion that the word politically corrupt has to be applied to that. I know lots of people who don't think niqabs are acceptable on a sort of social, just as a sort of a statement about the place of women in society, but who would be reluctant to say that we should make it impossible for someone to swear a citizenship oath when they're wearing.
Well, you know what? I think Canadians, legal, John, are you know? I think Canadians are extraordinarily tolerant and pluralistic people.
Right.
And that is reflected in the fact that in public opinion on this, well over 80% of Canadians believe that the citizenship oath should be taken publicly and not in hiding. Yet, you know, some people say, why can't you have women wearing face coverings go and do this in a separate room?
Yeah.
Because, and the answer is, I don't believe in segregation.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Jason Kenney, the Minister of Defence and Multiculturalism. For more on the interview with Kenney, go to macleans.ca.
Now, while Kenney was attacking Trudeau, his cabinet colleague, Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney, brought up the Holocaust in the debate on terrorism. As he testified in front of a committee studying Bill C-51, Blaney was defending a measure in the legislation that would ban the promotion of terrorism.
Holocaust did not begin in the gas chamber, it began with words. So we have to be careful, and that's why this measure, I feel, is so important.
Now, Blaney faced criticism for those comments as well, but also refused to apologize. We'll have more on the committee hearings into C-51 later in the show.
Back to the issue of the niqab. The Prime Minister was asked about it this week in the House of Commons by Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, and his response also sparked controversy.
We don't allow people to go uncovered, to cover their faces during citizenship ceremonies, and why would Canadians, contrary to our own values, embrace a practice at that time that is not transparent, that is not open, and frankly is rooted in a culture that is anti-women? And Mr. Speaker, that is unacceptable to Canadians, unacceptable to Canadian women.
Opposition leaders attacked Harper, claiming his anti-women comment was once again targeting Muslims.
To discuss the debate around the niqab and get her reaction to the Prime Minister's comments, I spoke with Amira Al-Gawabi, who is the Human Rights Coordinator of the National Council of Canadian Muslims.
What is your reaction to all of the debate that's been going on around the issue of the niqab, not just the court challenge and the appeal by the government, but all of the rhetoric that has come afterwards from the opposition and from the government?
So I think it's disappointing that this sort of issue is being made out to be so significant, in the sense that we're hearing so much discussion about what essentially affects a minority, a very tiny minority of women in Canada. And the courts have already been clear on this. The federal court said that the immigration minister's policy requesting that women remove the niqab at the oath was unlawful. The court has said that then Minister Jason Kenney should not have actually asked for that. And furthermore, we've also seen issues around Canadians wearing niqabs in court before with a case called NS. And at that time, the Supreme Court itself ruled that as long as someone has a sincerely held religious belief, that it should be respected, so long as there are no other concerns, there's no other right being impacted.
How does it make you feel when you have party leaders using this issue in this way, in what some are saying is just political rhetoric to create a wedge issue for voters?
Right. So, Exactly. I think it's really important, definitely, for Canadians to be aware that our politicians are making a lot of hay about this particular issue. This seems to be a way to pander to certain emotions that people may have around the niqab, visceral reactions to the niqab. This whole issue around the niqab is almost a diversion from the real matters at hand. As well, it conflates the issues around security and legitimate concerns with the practices of a minority of Canadian women within the Muslim community in this country. So it's really questionable why the need to conflate these issues around religious practice with at a time and a climate where Canadians are legitimately concerned about their security.
What do you specifically make of the Prime Minister's comment when he said that the niqab is a product of a culture that is anti-women?
Our response to the statement that the niqab is a product of a culture that is anti-women is that what is actually anti-women is for anyone, the state included, to be telling women what they can or cannot wear. This is the fundamental right for people to be able to choose how they want to dress themselves. We've already seen, a huge Twitter campaign where Canadians are, wondering, what's okay, what's not okay. I think that our laws are very clear that we all have responsibilities and that the state is there to protect us. However, how does that in any way, shape, or form justify the state then coming back to women to telling them that their choices for themselves as women is anti-women? I think that that's completely contradictory.
I believe NDP leader Thomas Mulcair said that the Prime Minister is sort of painting a broad brush with that and sort of insinuating that the country's Muslims are all anti-women. Is that what you take from it, or do you have a different view about the Prime Minister's comments?
He was referring specifically to the niqab, and so I do understand that the niqab certainly brings to mind a lot of legitimate concerns about women's right to choose. So there are countries around the world where women are forced and coerced to wearing niqab or burqas. And of course, this is completely un-Islamic and certainly would be considered anti-women. That being said, women also make the choice to wear the niqab at their own free will, out of a sense of a religious duty and a sense that they want to practice their faith in that manner, and they're certainly doing it out of a sense of their own independent thinking. So if he is the leader of our country, one would hope that he is actually speaking to Canadian Muslim groups, speaking to Canadian Muslim women, and being able then to be sort of better informed that, in fact, many women and the majority, if not all of the women who are in a club in Canada that have been, for example, surveyed, have said that they have done so out of their own free will. So whether we're telling a woman what to wear or what not to wear, I think any time we try to dictate that to anyone, I think there's definitely something wrong with that, and it's definitely contrary to what we all believe and aspire to.
The government has said, or ministers within the government have said, that the niqab issue is one of culture, not religion. Is this religious, or is this a cultural practice?
So in terms of whether or not it's religious or cultural, I think that attempt to try to show that the niqab is based on culture alone is really a false attempt at kind of muddying the waters. Basically, all that needs to happen for someone's charter right to sort of kick in is for them to say that they sincerely hold this religious belief. So within the religious text, there are interpretations of the religion that will say yes, that a woman should, for example, cover her hair. And other interpretations say yes, and she should cover her face as well. And other interpretations that said she neither has to cover her hair nor her face. She simply has to dress modestly, as do men have to dress modestly. So there's a lot of interpretation. Islam is actually very, very diverse in its practice, and the majority of women actually don't even cover their hair at all. And that's fine, because there's such a plurality of viewpoints within Islam. So it's far be it for anyone to say this is correct or this is incorrect. And ourselves as a human rights and civil liberties organization, we don't take any kind of theological view on this. We sort of stand just basic on the basic rights and freedoms that all Canadians have, and we are advocating on behalf of women in niqab, just as we would advocate for example, for someone wearing a turban or a kippah, that these are all expressions of religion, and as such, they are protected under the charter. So I think that Canadians, fellow Canadians, would be extremely troubled by all of this rhetoric that's sort of trying to divide Canadians against one another, almost creating a second-class citizens within our country. And I think this is completely unacceptable. And I think fellow Canadians are not going to fall for this.
The opposition is suggesting that the comments from the Prime Minister and the stance that the government has taken is stoking prejudice against Muslims. It could lead to Islamophobia. Is that something that you agree with? Is that a concern that you have?
Well, I think that our elected officials have a responsibility to ensure that they speak in inclusive terms, that they remind fellow Canadians that, you know, regardless of our diversity of background, diversity of views, diversity of religious practice, that we're all Canadians at the end of the day, and we all have the same rights and freedoms. So certainly this sort of divisive rhetoric is troubling, particularly when we do see incidents of anti-Muslim vandalism, for example, at mosques, where we hear document when, for example, people are verbally assaulted, whether sometimes even people feel threatened physically. We get reports here at the National Council of Canadian Muslims on that. So we know that there is a minority of fellow Canadians that may have views against Muslims that are, you know, that are based on uninformed understanding of the faith and what people believe. So it's not helping Canadians understand Islam when we have our elected officials speaking about, for example, niqab, suggesting that it's rooted in a culture that is anti-women, or earlier suggesting that when a woman is covering her face that she may not necessarily be part of the Canadian family. I think that sort of message is extremely troubling and potentially damaging and potentially harmful, because most of the people that phone us, the Canadians that phone us telling us that they've had any kind of incident, where anti-Muslim incident, are often women, because women are the most visible, visible clothing. If they're wearing hijab, which is the scarf covering the hair, or if they're wearing the niqab, you know, they're immediately visible and are the ones that often do face the brunt of anti-Muslim sentiment out there. So really, we've always been calling on our leaders to remind Canadians that we're all in this together.
That was Amira Al-Gawabi of the National Council of Canadian Muslims discussing the debate on the niqab.
Still to come on the show, committee hearings begin on the government's new anti-terror legislation. The Maclean's panel discusses the mission in Iraq, and just in time for St. Patrick's Day, we're joined by Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the Maclean's panel discusses the mission in Iraq following the tragic death of a Canadian soldier, and we speak about Irish-Canadian relations with Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister. But first,
the reality is that the international jihadi movement has declared war on Canada.
That's Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney, who helped kick off the committee hearings into the government's new anti-terror legislation this week. Along with the Justice Minister, Peter MacKay, Blaney defended the bill while being questioned by Conservative and opposition MPs.
Canadians are being targeted by jihadi terrorists simply because these terrorists hate our society and they hate our values. This is why our government has put forward measures that protect Canadians against jihadi terrorists who seek to destroy the very principles that make Canada the best country in the world to live.
While the first meeting was an exercise in defending the bill, the meetings that followed put the spotlight on those who want to see the bill changed or scrapped.
Carmen Chung with the BC Civil Liberties Association says there needs to be more oversight.
We cannot afford to enact this bill. because we cannot afford to further expand the reach of the scope of our national security activities without taking steps to ameliorate what is now a staggering accountability deficit.
Paul Champ with the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group isn't happy with relaxation of the rules around sharing personal information between government departments.
It is dropping the walls around privacy across government, and it gives a mandate to government officials in all of these departments to basically spy on Canadians.
And the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde, even called on the government to withdraw the bill entirely.
First Nations know better than anyone how easy it is for government to ignore, erode, and eradicate our most basic human rights and freedoms until you barely recognize the land you're living in. First Nations deserve better. Canadians deserve better.
Ron Atkey also appeared before the committee to share his expert opinion. Atkey, a former MP and cabinet minister, is also the former chair of the Security Intelligence Review Committee, which is in charge of reviewing the actions of Canada's spy agency, CSIS. I was able to reach Atkey on the phone, and he gives us his interpretation of the bill. He starts off by saying his primary concern is that the legislation would give judges the option to authorize CSIS actions that would otherwise violate the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
It's open to Parliament through urgings of the government to give the courts powers in terms of other laws, but you can't set aside the Charter. That's just unconstitutional. The Constitution is the Charter of Rights and Freedoms adopted in 1982 is a permanent part of our Constitution, is an overriding feature of our law, and that's the way it's been, and that's the law of the land. So it's a constitutional issue that could cause this bill to be ineffective, but it can be easily fixed through an amendment. And so I just say it's a bit of a constitutional mess, and it should be dealt with now.
Is this
and it's the sort of thing the committee should deal with. I don't think the government needs to go that far and say ignore the Charter if you have to. I don't think you need to say that in the law. There's lots of flexibility in our Constitution under Section 1 in the Limitations Clause for the judges to limit rights where it's reasonable and necessary in a free and democratic society, and it's done in a proportional way. There's almost 30 years of jurisprudence in terms of proportionality and balancing the Supreme Court of Canada, and I don't think the government should cast that out. If they really want to have a section sort of overriding the Charter, they can do that with the notwithstanding clause. Now, no government has felt the need to or had the courage to do that at the federal level. But if they want to do that, it's open to them. I think politically they'd pay a price if they did.
So
they've chosen this indirect way, and I don't think it's going to pass muster.
The other issue that's come up, and you would have sort of special insight on this, having been the chair of the Security Intelligence Review Committee, is this issue of oversight and review. How do you feel about CIRC at this point? Do you think it has the mandate and the power and the resources? And second to that, do you think that we need a parliamentary committee to additionally?
Well, those are three questions. but first of all, I think the CIRC structure is fine as it was conceived in 1984 and set up in a sort of a bipartisan way and operating with confidential information, having access to everything. But I think the resources, I mean, it's frozen in time in terms of its number of people and resources, which are not much different than they were in 1984, whereas the budget of the body that they review, which is CSIS, has grown exponentially. And so I think the government, I mean, this is not a parliamentary legislative issue, but I think the government has to get out its checkbook and to say, if you really want effective review by CIRC and you're going to rely on that, I think the structure is fine, but they have to be appropriately funded. It's not a matter of bringing in more members of CIRC, but making sure that their staff, legally cleared, security cleared staff who have legal training and couldn't do the investigative work that's necessary to monitor the extension of these extraordinary powers.
And then how about the idea of a parliamentary committee?
The parliamentary committee is one I'm not opposed to. I've been both a parliamentarian and a professional watchdog, and I think you can have both. I think the argument against a parliamentary committee is that, first of all, they can't be security cleared. And I think that's nonsense. You can have, you know, a small committee of senators and members of parliament who are committed to this work and can take an oath and observe that occurs in other jurisdictions. And they can be acting more like an overview committee. When a problem arises, that's where the matter first goes, and they're asked to look at that and to recommend the body, investigative body or review body that's best equipped to investigate the matter and get to the bottom issues. There are three bills currently before the Senate or Parliament that would establish a parliamentary or committee of parliamentarians is really the correct term, because it involves both the House and the Senate. And it's a small committee, which I think should overlook the implementation of these new extraordinary measures and conduct a five-year review, as happened in 1989 after the first CSIS Act, start maybe two, three years early, and then have a look at how these things are working, have full access to the documents and the agencies that are using the new powers, and see how they're working. If there are excesses, if there are abuses, they should privately make note of that and have a redacted report back to Parliament. So I think there is a role for a committee of parliamentarians. The best bill I like is the one S-220, which was drafted by former Conservative Senator Hugh Siegel. And I think it has some currency now, and put it in place as of January 1st, 2016, which is after the election, so it becomes a non-political issue, and have that as one of the safeguards against excess and abuse of power under the new provisions, and to conduct the five-year parliamentary review.
How difficult do you think it would be to get this bill to a point that it would deal with your concerns and the concerns of others, but still, you know, fulfill the government's desires for better protection?
I think it would be quite easy. I think if you see this by parallel, the legislation that the Martin government or the Chrétien government first brought forward in 2001 after 9/11, and there were some 23 days of hearings, and they make significant changes to the bill. And I think improved it as a result. I think when the first CSIS Act was brought in the early 80s by the Trudeau senior government, the provisions were changed. There were hearings and there were submissions, and the bill were changed significantly. The parliamentary review was set up, the provisions related to CERC were amended, and the powers limiting what CSIS can do were instituted. You know, Parliament's got to have some meaning. This just can't be an exercise of going through the motions by a government determined to barrel ahead. If that's the case, then they're just doing it for political reasons, not for substantive reasons. I don't think security, intelligence, and change of this nature is best debated in the context of an election campaign. I think Parliament has a duty, all parties, to protect Canadians, and if they're terrorists, threat is increasing, I think Parliament should act accordingly. So I don't like it being put into boxes and you're with us or against us. I think it's got to be a cooperative effort.
That was Ron Ackey, the former chair of the Security Intelligence Review Committee, discussing the government's new anti-terror legislation.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. And I'm joined by Paul Wells, a political editor for Maclean's, and John Geddes, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief. Thanks very much for joining me, guys. All right, so we had a sad incident happen over the last week with a Canadian soldier fighting in Iraq, a part of the mission against ISIS. He was killed by friendly fire after hitting a checkpoint. There's much dispute about what exactly happened. We're hearing reports that they tried to come up with a passcode to get through, and it wasn't identified by somebody who just started opening fire. There are investigations underway into all of this, but Paul, I'll start with you. What does it exactly mean for the mission after this death, at a time when Canadians are looking at whether or not they want to extend the mission?
Well, it's a horrible event, and it drives home, to some extent, the NDP's point that to the extent that parliamentarians thought they had ironclad guarantees that there'd be nothing resembling combat, this sure looks like combat. And the constant reports that Canadian troops have been engaged violently by the people they're over there to fight and have been responding, I mean, once again, that looks like we're in for something a little nastier than what people might have thought when Parliament, the Conservatives, voted to implement this mission last fall. And that will play into the decision about whether to continue it. But I don't think it's going to make or break a continued deployment. The Conservatives alone can extend this mission, and it looks like they're set on doing it. But it reminds everyone that there simply is no antiseptic way to send troops into a violent situation. And it's delusional to think that there's some corner of a violent situation that's going to be safe enough that we don't have to worry about. I mean, it's inherently a chaotic situation, and sometimes tragically a deadly one.
John, picking up on the "it's a chaotic situation" theme that Paul ends on there, I spoke with Defense Minister Jason Kenney a little earlier in the week. I think we had some clips on the show of him talking about another issue, but we asked him about the situation in Iraq. He, not surprisingly, said that Canada won't be dissuaded from the decision to possibly extend the mission by the fact there's been a death there. The minister said that he thought that Sergeant Doron's colleagues would want the fight to be carried on, or that mission to be carried on. That being said, though, it is a chaotic situation, and this situation was chaotic. We've got the northern Iraq city of Tikrit apparently on the verge of being retaken by the Iraqis from Islamic State right now. And there, the complicating situation is that a lot of the fighting is done by Shia militias who are led in to a large degree by Iranian army officers. So hard to follow the game here without a lot of background, but the Shiite-Sunni split in Iraq is the biggest complicating factor in all this. Islamic State is a terrorist group, but it draws its support mainly from Sunnis. The Iranians are Shiite, the Shiite powerhouse in the region. It's very complicated. And one thing that Kenny was taking pains to point out to me is that Canada does not want to unintentionally get drawn into somehow being a player in a Shia-Sunni split. Canada's there, wants a clear mission, and that's fight ISIS. They don't want to be part of a broader, more complex situation. So there's the complexity of where are we relative to the front line, and also the complexity of where are we relative to the bigger geopolitical questions in the region.
So do you think, based on what we've seen and the issue with combat, should we expect the government to possibly change the wording of the mandate in this next motion that they're promising to bring forward if they decide to extend?
I get the impression they're not in a mood to. I think the Prime Minister kind of likes the situation where he's the only party voting in favor of extending this mandate. The question, of course, is whether Trudeau and the Liberals will change their tack. I mean, I've had Liberal MPs ask me whether they think that that voting to renew the mission makes any sense after they did not vote in the first place to deploy. So they're clearly nervous about whether even 6 months later, whether that decision in September made any sense and whether it hurt them politically. But the NDP is going to be against it, and the government's going to be for it, and I think it's going to happen. I think we're going to have a fairly open-ended extension of this deployment. And every indication I've seen is that a pretty strong majority of Canadians support that choice.
Okay, so moving on to another issue that we have addressed earlier in the show, the issue of the niqab, which came to the forefront after this controversial speech by Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, and then more comments from the Prime Minister in the House of Commons. Paul, you were writing about it this week. What's your take on this whole controversy?
Trudeau has, to some extent, ruined the Conservative Party's game. And the Conservative Party has been very successful for most of the last decade at increasing their support both among immigrants and members of cultural communities in Canada and among people who are suspicious of immigration, partly by being tougher on cases where there's a clear infringement of the rules. And so the government has been able to maintain high levels of immigration, get historically high levels of immigrant votes for the Conservative Party, and also pretty much nail down the constituency of people who wish we didn't have as much immigration as we do. Now Justin Trudeau and says you're a bunch of bigots. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's the impression he wanted to leave. And the government has been rung like a bell and entirely unsure about how to respond. They could polarize. They could say you're a terrorist lover, and we're going to stand up for good, decent Canadians. But they've got to guard their immigrant flank. They've got to make sure that they can protect the immigrant vote. And so the response instead has been to move closer to the Liberal position, to reassert the Conservative government's record of support for diversity in the way people dress, including at the federal workplace, to say that you can wear a niqab if you want, including at your desk as a federal bureaucrat, and to try and deny Trudeau the wedge that he's seeking. But various remarks, including those by the Prime Minister, suggest that the government hasn't really yet decided how to play this.
I think there's an interesting thing here about the kinds of symbols that the parties pull into their under their banner. Conservatives have done a pretty good job of getting the maple leaf and the flag. You know, we've got the huge flags behind the Prime Minister whenever he speaks. Even though it's a red flag, he seems to be able to incorporate it into his set of icons, right? But one thing the government's never been really comfortable with is the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And to the degree that Trudeau here is reminding people that his dad and his party are the champions of the Charter, which is, remains, from what I can tell, very popular with Canadians, you know. Rights and freedoms is a nice phrase to identify. So to some degree, I think what Trudeau is doing here is reminding people of that brand strength, an element of the Liberal brand that the Conservatives have really never been able to get a piece of. And frankly, I don't think want a piece of it. I think they're pretty uncomfortable with the Charter on many levels. So there's that interesting element, too.
And we'll end right there. Thank you very much, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, Maclean's political editor Paul Wells, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Still to come on the show, as we approach St. Patrick's Day, we speak with Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister about Irish-Canadian relations.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Well, we're just days away from a big moment on the Irish calendar. March 17th is St. Patrick's Day, a day when everybody is a little Irish, and many of us actually are.
According to the 2006 census, more than 4.3 million Canadians identified themselves as having ethnic ties to the Emerald Isle. Canada and Ireland have a long history, and the official relationship between our governments remains strong, especially with a recent surge of Irish coming to our country.
Well, to speak more about Irish-Canadian relations, I'm joined on the phone by Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister Charlie Flanagan, who is in Toronto for bilateral meetings and, of course, St. Patrick's Day festivities. All right, Minister, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here in Toronto, this great Canadian city. It's my first visit here, and it's a privilege for me to have been invited to participate in the parade and have the opportunity of meeting with many groups here to reinforce the very positive relationship between Ireland and Canada, which has never been as strong.
It's been definitely growing over the last number of years. There are millions of Canadians who say they're from Irish stock, but how many Irish citizens are actually living in Canada?
Yeah, well, there are thousands of Irish citizens here in Canada, many of whom have emigrated in recent times and more of whom emigrated as a result of our economic difficulties in the past, looking to the present and indeed to the future. Toronto and Canada is a key area for pursuing further objectives in relation to job creation, in relation to trade. And I had the opportunity this morning of having a lengthy engagement with Rob Nicholson, the foreign minister, building on a very solid relationship which I had with his predecessor, John Baird. Also had the opportunity of meeting Mr. Oliver, the finance minister. So we've been discussing what we have in common, Ireland and Canada, in terms of investment, in terms of trade, in terms of looking after our respective people.
What were some of the main topics of discussion that you had? Did CETA pop up in those discussions?
We have in excess of 2.5 billion euros worth of trade in terms of our bilateral relationship, I feel that there is huge opportunity throughout a range of financial services, throughout a range of high-tech and IT, in order to ensure that we can build on what is a very strong relationship. The fact that the recently signed EU and Canada trade agreement, the CETA, I was pleased that was concluded late last year. That agreement has a further potential to enhance even further the level of trade in terms of exports from Ireland to Canada and bilateral trade between our respective people. So all in all, it's a very positive story. I was very pleased to discuss with Minister Nicholson, Ireland's role in the European Union, the relationship between Canada and the European Union, matters of foreign policy dealing with Ukraine, the Middle East, and also our respective and very positive engagement as members of the United Nations, where we have much in common.
Now, on the European free trade deal, I mean, yes, it has been signed, but it hasn't been ratified yet, and that seems to be an issue on the EU side of things. Is Ireland trying to convince its counterparts, its allies within the EU to make sure that it is ratified?
I think it's important that that's done at an early date. Obviously, from the European Union, from a negotiating point of view, there are 28 national member states, oftentimes with varying and diverse views. However, the agreement has been reached in principle, and I think it's essential that at an early date it can be fully ratified, and that the great potential that's there in terms of further developing our trade links comes to pass. I'm confident that that will happen in the near future.
You know, Canada has not long ago expanded the number of visas given to Irish people who are looking for jobs in our country. Now, I believe you mentioned that a little bit earlier. Is there any work on your behalf to try and increase that even further, given the situation right now? I know over the last couple of years, I've met many Irish people who have come over to Canada looking for work, and some of them are family members of mine. Is there a chance to increase that further? Is that something you're looking to do?
I think the new visa arrangements between Ireland and Canada are working very well. There certainly is an opportunity for many young, highly skilled and qualified Irish people to come over to Canada, work here for a number of years, participate in your economic development, get training here in Canada, contribute strongly to the Canadian economy and gain experience. Obviously, it's my hope that at some stage in the future, many of these highly skilled and trained personnel will return to Ireland. However, I have met hundreds of people over the last couple of days who have settled here in Canada, who very much enjoy the lifestyle here in Canada, many of whom have settled here in Canada, have children, and they've taken up roots here. And they're very proud of their strong Irish-Canadian links.
The government of Ontario, the province of Ontario, reached a deal with Ireland to honor the driver's licenses of Ontario in Ireland so that visitors could head out there and get behind the wheel and rent a car and go explore the island. Have you expanded beyond just Ontario? What other provinces are involved in this, and are you working to get more on board with this deal?
I have been instrumental in ensuring that the driving license situation has been resolved as far as Ontario is concerned. I also understand that a resolution has been found in Saskatchewan, in New Brunswick, and that there are the ratification in respect of two other provinces, Manitoba and Newfoundland, have been advanced and are in the course of a successful conclusion. We have ongoing contact over the other five provinces. I will be reporting back directly to my colleague, the Minister for Transport, Pascal Donoghue, but I am pleased that there has been an element of progress as far as the arrangements are concerned, and I would hope again that we would make progress on this issue during the course of the current year.
That was the Irish Foreign Affairs Minister, Charlie Flanagan, discussing Irish-Canadian relations in the lead-up to St. Patrick's Day.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.